Prairie Week magazine, where many of her writings appear. She's recently retired. She retired after 20 years of service in the Air Force, retiring as a lieutenant colonel, and she worked in the Office of Secretary of Defense, and then a big long list of qualifiers: Undersecretary for Policy, Sub-Saharan Africa and Near East Southeast Asia Policy Directorates, and I'll ask her to explain those in a little bit more detail. She has an MA in government from Harvard, an MS in science management from the University of Alaska, and has completed a number of air training programs in the military, including the Air Command and Staff College and the Naval War College programs. And she's working on a PhD, working on the topic of the overt and covert war in Angola at the moment at Catholic University. So, Karen, welcome to our program.
Well, thanks. It's good to be here.
So I wonder if we could start out. Maybe I think many of our listeners don't know very much about you or your background or your writings. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the air was to acquaint people with your work. So I wondered if maybe you could start out by explaining, as I did awkwardly, what your job was like a year or two ago inside the Pentagon, and what you did there, and what your responsibilities were.
Okay, in my my final assignment was at the Pentagon, working in the Office of Secretary of Defense in the Undersecretary for Policy. And I was assigned over there to work Sub-Saharan African Affairs. But in May of 2002, I was moved over into Near East South Asia, which is the Middle East Directorate. They were short on people, and they made a call for volunteers, didn't get any, called for non-volunteers, and I was one of them who was tasked to go over there. At that point, there was no Office of Special Plans per se. There was work going on, special work going on, but there wasn't an Office of Special Plans. But by August, several months after I was assigned there, the Office of Special Plans emerged from this Office of Near East South Asia Policy, and it was initially the Expanded Iraq Desk. And that group, I was not assigned inside of Office of Special Plans, but I was part of Near East South Asia, working for Bill Luty, who was the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for NISA, Near East South Asia, in the Office of Special Plans. So that was where I worked, and it didn't take very long after I was assigned into that office to really have my eyes open to some of the things that were going on as far as this run-up to this invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, so I'd be very interested to know, to hear your thoughts about that, if you could tell us a bit more. What exactly, I don't know, like, what exactly was your job? Is it possible,
to
explain that?
Yeah, it really, my job, along with many other people that were of the lieutenant colonel and colonel rank, or civil servant grade GS-14 and GS-15, which is the equivalent, was as a political military staff officer, political military analyst. So I was assigned the North Africa desk, ultimately. Initially, when I went there, I had the Southern Arabian Gulf, several countries there. The job that we had, all of us military, political military staff officers, would be to advise and develop policy options, any background information, to review intelligence on a routine basis regarding our area of assignment, our area of expertise. And in my case, it was North Africa, but it could have been any of those other regions. In some larger countries like Pakistan, they might have one person dedicated to one country. In smaller countries, a staff officer might have several countries that he would be responsible for.
I see. Okay. So it's fair to say you were privy to a lot of secret information, I assume, in that position?
Yeah.
Okay. So does that present problems for you in like explaining your
position?
No,
it really doesn't, because the information that I have articulated publicly isn't classified, or if it was classified, it's already been declassified because the president and the vice president have discussed it openly. So really haven't, whether for good or for bad, I have not brought new classified information to light. But in general, the information that I saw at the secret level is pretty much what you could read in the New York Times, basically.
I see. Okay. I've often heard people say that there's it's less interesting than it sounds like from the outside. So before we go into some of the details, let me just clear the air on one other thing, which is you retired voluntarily, like you weren't forced out or?
No, I did retire voluntarily. I had two back-to-back tours at the Pentagon. This was my second tour. Prior to that, I had worked on the air staff. And my next assignment was due to be, I was due to rotate in the fall of 2003, and I intended to retire. I always intended to retire in the fall of 2003. I did move my retirement up several months, and I retired in the 1st of July of 2003, and I did that specifically because I had been assigned, not volunteered, but assigned into Near East South Asia, in with the neoconservative mindset. My exposure to that was such that I really could not, you know, I couldn't stay any longer than absolutely necessary. But I did retire at 20 years and 3 months, I think, and that was, by my choice. In fact, that's never really been an issue. And I had 19 really good years in the military, and it was that last 10 months working for the neoconservatives and having my eyes open that really, was very frustrating for me.
So that's what made you give up on the military at that point? That was a little...
Well, I had intended to retire in any case.
So it was a combination?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was a combination. I accelerated that retirement specifically because of the policies, mm-hmm. But I had always intended to retire. I would have been due to rotate and move one more time had I not retired, and I preferred to settle here where I live in the western part of Virginia.
Rather than move again or something?
Yeah, because I have mm-hmm. a bunch of kids in school and that kind of thing.
So it's fair to say you're not a disgruntled ex-employee?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Could I just... I know you've written several articles, as we mentioned, and we have links to them on our website, leftout.info. You can go there and find links to some articles. One of them is an article that you wrote called The New Pentagon Papers, and that appeared in Salon.com. There was another article that you played a major role in at least being interviewed. It was The Lie Factory, which appeared in Mother Jones Magazine. Could you just briefly, take a couple of minutes and mm-hmm. just tell us what was the most sort of disturbing things or the most shocking things that you found out, or what was the things that disgusted you from your work in the Office of Special Plans?
Well, there were several things. I think early on in my assignment there in May of 2002, two things were surprising to me. One was the very much pro-Israel perspective of the political appointees, which we are pro-Israel in this country because Israel is an ally that we have, but it went beyond being pro-Israel and almost to contempt for certainly Palestinians, but I think by extension other Arab cultures. So in one sense, it was surprising to see that. So that was at the very beginning I noticed that, and I had signs that there was some bias there. The other thing that surprised me, and maybe it shouldn't have surprised me, but it did surprise me, and that was that the war in Iraq was already pretty much considered a done deal. It was going to happen, and this was as early in my experience, May of 2002. In May of 2002, this, right when I was assigned there, Tommy Franks had already had several revisions of his Iraq invasion plan, had already been coordinated by the Office of Secretary of Defense. And I, having worked in the Sub-Saharan Africa policy directorate prior to this, was not privy to this. Didn't pay much attention. Didn't think it was that far along. Didn't realize that this war in Iraq was not only intended, but seriously going to happen. Not much was going to change that. And that surprised me. I think had I been less naive, maybe I would have not been surprised by that, but I was. So that happened early on. And then throughout the summer, in relating to the idea that this war was a done deal, that it was going to happen, was the level of propagandistic messages and information that was put out, not just outside the Pentagon, not just by the White House, but internal to the Pentagon, which was basically not just beating the drums of war in Iraq, but giving the reason for this war as some new kind of a threat that Iraq posed to the United States. And this goes beyond the very false connection that was made by the president and by the administration that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. Of course, we knew that wasn't the case, but there was a case being made internal to the Pentagon and to the American people and to the Congress that Saddam Hussein's military threat, his WMD threat, and all of the other ways that he might threaten not his neighbors but the United States was this huge growing thing, and that was contradictory to everything that we had seen and studied in the previous 8 years. And I worked on the air staff prior to the OSD, and I worked Middle East issues there. So we'd been looking at Iraq. We understood the kind of threat that Iraq posed, both in a traditional sense, conventional sense, and in a less conventional WMD sense. And this threat was not, it was a decreasing threat. it was debatable that it was ever very much. It was certainly a fourth-rate military power to begin with, a typical Soviet-era, Soviet-style military, which we had already met in combat and destroyed in 1991. So, you know, the idea that suddenly, after 12 years of sanctions and no-fly zone enforcement, suddenly Iraq was this not just a dangerous enemy and a threat to the United States, but the dangerous enemy and the threat to the United States, over and above others that, of course, existed and exist today. That was very strange. You know, it's one thing for the politicians to put forth these agendas. For Dick Cheney to do this is one thing. He certainly had a bug under his, a burr under his saddle about Iraq for a long time. But for internal to the Pentagon, where we had, pretty much an objective perspective on the threat that Iraq posed, to hear it coming from within the Pentagon was very disturbing.
So is it fair to say that sort of people in your position, I mean, it was commonly understood that this was baloney?
Oh, yeah, commonly understood that this was baloney for sure. And, you know, I'm a lieutenant colonel. I was a lieutenant colonel, and a relatively junior one. I retired with exactly 3 years time and grade, which is the minimum time and grade you have to retire at that rank. So I was a junior lieutenant colonel. And yet I was advised by many people senior to me, both civilians and military, who not only shared my view but helped shape my view and explained to me, Karen, this looks like the reason this looks like it is because your gut instincts are right on this. It's our gut instincts as well. Information and propaganda is being developed. Information is being perverted. Intelligence is being misused to pursue a political agenda. And so it was well known by my coworkers and I believe many of my superiors as well. Not neoconservatives, of course, but people that were in positions to have knowledge and awareness and understanding and perspective. That they knew exactly what was going on.
So the career people and not the political appointees. Or,
sure. Now, see, here's the thing. Most of the people who had this perspective and saw what was going on and understood it were not in the channels of decision-making for the Iraq policy, the Iraq strategy. That was entirely, and this is another thing that I observed over the summer, the Office of Special Plans, which stood up in August of 2002, was almost entirely populated by handpicked political appointees, many from neoconservative think tanks, all neoconservatives, all of the ones that they actually hired from outside, the consultants, the contractors, the political appointees, all neoconservatives. And so it wasn't as if folks, even senior folks who had a different view, were able to impact this, were able to say, well, have you thought of this or what about this, and doesn't really jive with the intelligence. They weren't in the meetings. No. They were simply excluded from the decision-making. So that was another kind of a strange thing to see that kind of a... I mean, to bring, you know, it's one thing if it's a particular policy affecting a service or the Defense Department. It's another thing to take a country to war and have a very closed decision-making process filled with basically people who all agree with each other, and not only all agree with each other, but have done so for over a decade. So I mean, most of these folks had been working together in organizations, whether various think tanks, Project for New American Century, American Enterprise Institute. I mean, these people had been singing to the choir long before even the Clinton administration.
Right.
Certainly for the duration of the Clinton administration, they were processing their views and writing their formulas for America's, a strategy, particularly America's strategy with regard to Iraq. And so, when Bush brought a bunch of these folks in and they populated the decision-making positions, they were home free. They did not need to articulate, defend, discuss, and so, explain any of what they were doing.
And so the reason for that is because, of course, that they were tight with Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, I presume.
Well, and Cheney. Cheney was the one that actually, remember, before Cheney accepted the vice presidency, he was helping Bush handpick his staff.
Yes,
and
that's right. Picked himself.
Cheney was key with this. In fact, Bill Lutie, who was a relatively low-level player, the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for NISA and OS Office of Special Plans, Bill Lutie had been a staffer, military aide for Dick Cheney when Cheney was the secretary.
Right, okay.
So yeah,
you get figures like that, and
group,
Douglas Feith, I suppose, and people on the Defense Policy Board.
Yeah, Doug Feith, of course, his connections with certainly a neoconservative, dyed-in-the-wool neoconservative, but his connections are very much... even more interesting. When he was, when he was confirmed as the Undersecretary for Policy, there was a a number of complaints and arguments made against him being confirmed as the Defense Undersecretary for Policy, primarily because as a key partner in Fipe and Zelle, his law firm,
mm-hmm.
that he had his prime customer, primary overseas customer, was the state of Israel. It was the military
right.
of Israel and some other government agencies in Israel.
Right, and Richard Perle had connections with the Netanyahu government.
Well, sure enough. Well, that's his clean break document, which mm-hmm. in 1996 advocates the imposition of a friendly government in Baghdad. He wrote that for Netanyahu's campaign. So, I mean, many of the ideas, I don't think that what we've done in Iraq is in Israel's interest in practical terms. I don't think it helps Israel. But I can tell you the Likud party views what many of these neoconservatives are advocating in Washington as something that they can live with and that is agreeable to them. Not necessarily good for Israel. As you can tell, Israel's economy is still tanked. They have just as much violence and probably more than they've had before, and the risk to Israel is great. So this is not a good, our invasion of Iraq is not a good idea for Israel in any case.
Yeah, good. So I'd like to get into that a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
But for to follow up on a few of your points. So the mm-hmm. picture I have is that sort of the career military people such as you were kind of just forced to go along with all of this because there was really no mechanism for you to influence it. Mm-hmm. And so you were just kind of looking on with horror as this as all of this policies emerge.
I think that's a good way to say it. And the professional civilians as well watched this with in horror.
And I understand, I don't know the inside story, but from the outside it seemed clear that some people who were dissenters were pushed aside. I mean, the first person that comes to mind is Shinseki, who certainly seemed to have a much clearer idea of what was involved here than any of these characters.
Well, sure. Shinseki had been a problem for Rumsfeld for a long time. You know, I mean, he announced Shinseki's replacement months and months
ago. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And he had issues. Rumsfeld, remember before 9/11, Rumsfeld's big thing was transformation of the army, something Shinseki had been working on for some time. But their views of transformation of the army, a necessary thing, it's something that needs to happen, but their views differed. And Shinseki's a tough cookie. Was not intimidated by Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld operates, at least as I understand it, in somewhat of a personally intimidating way. I mean, he's the kind of person he'll knock you on your chest. He'll physically get inside of your space and that kind of thing. And it's kind of just a very much bird-like behavior, really. And Shinseki did not respond in the way that Rumsfeld wanted him to. And so they had issues, I think, from early on. But certainly Shinseki's concern with the Tommy Franks war plan. I mean, they had the idea that we would need a couple hundred thousand at least to go do what they wanted to do. And that was rejected by Rumsfeld soundly because Rumsfeld, I think, in some ways was out to use Iraq as a test case for his idea of light and lean. In any case, Shinseki spoke out, and Shinseki was removed ultimately.
Yeah, he was pushed aside.
But the other guy that really is a prime example of their disregard for knowledge and wisdom and military perspective is their treatment of General Tony Zinni, who had
mm-hmm.
he was Frank's predecessor down at Central Command,
mm-hmm.
and knew tons about the Middle East, of course, privy to the highest levels of intelligence and confidence of this government as a combatant commander.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he had, after he retired, served as George Bush's Middle East envoy up until around November time frame, November of 2002, when he publicly made some comments that could be interpreted as speaking out against the neoconservative agenda, the neoconservative project for Iraq, and he was gone. He was not only gone, but I heard, and I wrote about this at the time in my anonymous columns that I had written while I was still active duty, but Bill Luddy called Tony Zinni a traitor in the office in front of several witnesses.
It's disgusting, but hardly surprising given everything we've seen since then.
Luddy and the neoconservatives, Luddy is typical of the neoconservatives in that, just like George Bush says, if you're not with us, you're against us. And that goes beyond a national kind of slogan. It's very much a narrow political slogan.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Yeah.
So we see the politicization of the Pentagon, and I think how a lot of this stuff came about. So what I would like to do is I will take a brief break, and then I would like to come back and talk about what is really the purpose, what is really going on, and who is benefiting afterward.
Let me just make a comment that callers can please call us up at 412-621 9728. That's 621-WRCT. And Karen has a tremendous amount of knowledge, as you can tell. And if you have questions about anything about the military, what's going to happen next, about what happened before, the propaganda system, the media, any questions like that, I'm sure we could shed a lot of light and a lot of very interesting opinions about that. So please give us a call.
We'll be back in a moment.
Suddenly it's over, the war is finally done. Soldiers in the desert sand still clinging to a gun. No one is the winner, and everyone must lose. Suddenly the war is over, that's the news. Suddenly celebrity is something back in style. Back to running tabloid for a while. Pain's almost everywhere. The whole world's got the blues. Suddenly the war is over. That's the news. That's the news. That's the news. That's the ever-loving, blessed headline news. Someone's missing in Modesto, and it's sad about the clues. Suddenly the war is over, that's the news. Suddenly the cost of war is something out of sight. Lost a lot of heroes in the fight. Politicians do all the talking. Soldiers pay the dues. Suddenly the war is over. That's the news. That's the news.